The Crown Heights History Project, Bridging Easton Parkway, interview with Joe Haynes, 666 St. Mark's Avenue, 31 August 1993, Craig Wilder, interviewer. If you can just describe where you were born and when for me.
Yeah, I was born on Green Avenue between Franklin and Clawson in 1931. At the time, my father owned the brownstone over there. And I think because of the Depression, he lost it. So then we moved up to Rochester Avenue between Dean and Bergen. And later we moved down to Sumter Street, 19 Sumter Street. That's where Sumter Street intersects Fulton Street. And we lived there, and then we left there and went to 1808 Dean Street. That's between Utica and Schenectady. And I attended PS 83 at that time. And just about the time we were ready to graduation at public grade school, we moved down to 361 Cumberland Street. That's between Fulton and Atlantic. But that block has been, all the houses have been torn down for about three or four blocks around. So it's been like a open lots for about the last five, maybe 10 years. And so we lived there until about 51. Then we moved up here to 652 St. Mark's. That's just a few doors away from here. And then, of course, I went to school, then I got married, and I moved to Ebbets. Well, at that time, they tore down Ebbetsfield, and they built an Ebbetsfield apartment house. So I lived in there, then I lived on Washington Avenue, across from the Botanical Garden, then back over here.
Let me ask you, most of that was in the central Brooklyn area.
Yeah.
What did central Brooklyn look like in the 1930s, 1940s?
Well, Fulton Street was like something like a divide line. Most of these areas, white people, mostly Italians that I knew about, and the Jewish people, because these are most of the kids in my school, I remember being Jewish and Italian. And here and there, there was a scattering of blacks. Not that the concentration of blacks were more on the other side of Fulton Street. See, and
the other side being north.
Being north of Fulton Street,
okay.
You know.
Okay.
But then all along Eastern Parkway was white, mostly Jewish. I remember I had a couple of Jewish schoolmates, and when the Jewish holidays came, you would see a lot of Jewish people out and in the parks and things like that. So and. Then you had a lot of small mom and pop shops throughout the neighborhood. Well, we spent most of our time up around Utica and Rochester, that area. So it's a lot of small merchants. Fulton Street was full of small merchants. And so most of the shopping was done in those areas. And most of them, as I recall, most of them, except for barbershops, were white-owned stores.
What did your family do for fun? Who did you socialize with?
Believe it or not, I often think about it when I go up there, because we lived, most of the, when we were playing games and fun was, we lived on Dean Street, right on the corner of Rochester. That was another place we lived. We originally had lived between, we had one time lived between, on Rochester, between Dean and Bergen, and then later on we went to Dean Street twice, once in a little frame house and once in the apartment. Now that's the time I remember when we were growing up playing games, and most of the people were, well, in that block, there were a few black families, so you hung out with them. And there were six children in my family, so we played a lot, together. And then the other children that we played with would be children, other black children who attended the same church that we attended, because they kind of lived around that neighborhood. Then other than that, I had a friend of mine, an Italian friend, who he was a classmate of mine. So he lived on Bergen near Utica. So I would spend time with him, and then there was another Jewish kid. I don't know whether he's in our class or not, but he lived on Rochester, so we spent a lot of time with him also. And what I would do with all my Italian friend, the Jewish friend, we would go up to that park up on Rochester in Eastern Parkway. We used to go to that park. And I remember most of the time, the winter time, because they used to go mostly with sleds, or just hanging out in that cold weather. Like, you couldn't figure out how they could stand out. But I would, since I was paralyzed, I would go with them and literally freeze to death. But that's the easiest was with my brothers and sisters, because we were kind of close at that time. And then when we moved out of that circle, it was like that classmate, or either one or two people that we know that went attended the same church.
Do you remember the name of the church you went to?
Yeah, that was a church headed by Elder Clemens, and it was Church of God in Christ. At that time, he had a little store on storefront church on Herkimer Street. Later on, they moved over to Pacific Street. That's where that Department of Sanitation garage is now. And they converted an automobile garage in that time into a church, and that was like a huge church at the time. So that's where we went. Up until the time we moved downtown, which at that time was about 15 or 16 years, well, it wasn't quite that old. Probably about 11 years old, that's about the time. But a lot of social events also dealt around the church with the plays that they used to put on and things like that.
And did the church provide most of the entertainment for, or a lot of the entertainment for black people in Brooklyn? Churches?
I think, my church, it mostly was like the plays that they would put on or presentations. So going to church, if you want to call it entertainment, that's what's a social thing. The other thing around the corner was Marine, from where I lived when we lived on Dean Street, was Marine Baptist Church on Bergen Street. And they had a Boy Scout troop. And we used to, I didn't belong to it, but we would go over there when they had activities going on. See, so that's the kind of way you focus. So.
What did your parents do for a living at that time?
Well, my father, he was a plasterer, so he used to go out and do plastering. But he didn't belong to the union, so he didn't make the kind of salaries that they were, that union workers. But he made enough to support us. And then my mother, I know she, at one time she was a domestic, then later on, because then she used to sew, and then later on she became a milliner, making hats and things. But as kids, I mean, most of the time, I think she did domestic work.
Was your father trying to get into the union, or had he tried several times, to your knowledge?
I don't know. I never really asked him to see that he... I know later on, just before he retired, he got in, because there was a lot of signals sent down about, where blacks can go and what they can do, and so... I never remember being around blacks, even my parents who were militant, like you would say militant and outspoken. It was just very quiet, a lot of things were accepted. You didn't go to certain neighborhoods, you didn't, white people had certain privileges you didn't have.
And as a kid, did you know that? Did you sort of recognize those symbols or signals?
Yeah.
And so you avoided certain places, or?
Oh yeah, you avoided certain places. Ironically, this neighborhood was one of them, because it was like a kind of wealthy, this very block, right? And, another thing we used to do, we used to go to Brooklyn Children's Museum, the Children's Museum. That was a place. But we weren't allowed to go to the movies. Most of the kids in our neighborhood did go to the movies, but we weren't allowed. My parents didn't allow us. So the only time we used to get to see a movie is we went over to the Brooklyn Children's Museum, because they always had some cartoon or something going, or some movie going on. And then they had that, hands-on thing with looking at bugs and different kind of animals.
You were saying you...
Yeah, so that Children's Museum was one of the places where another, entertaining, learning and doing things that were unusual. And then one of the things my brother and sisters we used to do, we used to just go explore and just walk up different blocks, some of the blocks this way to see what it looked like. And when we were smaller, I remember my mother and my aunt, they used to take us and go up and down Fulton Street. You go window shopping, because they had a lot of shops and a lot of things in the store windows, which you don't see nowadays, especially if you went towards, Broadway Junction in that area. So that's the thing, I see in some small town, but I don't see here.
Right.
The people used to just go just strolling with the kids and go window shopping.
Did people utilize the parks a lot? Was that important too?
Well, the closest park to us was that park up at the Eastern Parkway.
Mm-hmm.
And I only recall going there when I went with this Italian and Jewish kid, go there. occasionally we would venture over to Prospect Park, see, but not that often. And then Fulton Street was the closest park. And I call that a sitting park. And I remember as a youngster, my mother did take us there, and we would just sit, and my mother would sit with other women, and then we would just run around on the grass.
You grew up, or at several times you lived fairly closely to Weeksville, which was rediscovered recently. Well, you helped rediscover it. Let me ask, was there any sort of remnants of Weeksville when you were a kid?
Those same houses. There were a number of houses situated off of Bergen Street, what we used to call up alleys. Mm-hmm. I don't recall going up that particular one. That one doesn't ring a bell. But further, closer down to Rochester, there were a couple of kids that were in my class lived in houses up in those alleys. Mm-hmm. So we would go up there and see them. So I remember that.
What did they look like?
These little wooden frame houses. I don't remember going in them. I remember we used to play outside or meet the kids. Yeah. But I remember going up the alleyways there.
And were they still occupied?
They were occupied, people lived there.
Okay, all right. How has this community changed over your lifetime?
Well, first of all, it's mostly black now. But I don't know if any white people live around here. I think I know one guy because he bought a house. Notion Avenue used to be really, I heard one person call it the Fifth Avenue of Brooklyn. They had a lot of fine shops. Because I remember later on when I lived downtown, I worked for a German butcher. And I used to go up to, come up to Notion Avenue. Not too far off of Atlantic, there was a place that made shoes, handmade shoes. And there were places that sold nurses' uniforms, professional uniforms. There were bakeries, there were ice cream parlors, and just a whole different class of, a gift shop used to be up on Notion Avenue near St. John's. So a lot, nice little gifts and things, but you don't see that anymore. So the quality is mostly stores selling low quality products. And by the way, most of the stores are owned by white. I don't remember any black person having any store along there. Then there was it used to be a set of diners like Horn and Harnock, mm-hmm. but there was a lot of Bickford's. That used to be down there, Notion Avenue, those big restaurants serving sandwiches and coffee and stuff like that. That's gone. There were more banks here. And then the service is no longer here.
Jobs did you have as you grew up?
Because as a kid, I would go with my father when he had some jobs on weekends. I would go with him on jobs, and more or less, I didn't do anything serious. I think a lot of it was play now that I think about it. But just the idea of going, that he was going to work and I was going, and that was good. So I got an idea about working. So then, when they tore down the houses to build those houses, I think Kingsborough houses, that's on Rochester between, and across from Weeksville, there was a steam shovel, what we call them steam shovels, those did shovels that dig the soil, power shovels. I was so fascinated by the machine, so there was a mechanic, so he used to let us hang out, and then I became like the one that was always there when he was servicing it. So I used to hang around there during the summertime when they were building those buildings. Then later on, we had a landlord that owned most of those houses, Italian guy. And I remember he was, he said, when they're tearing down those houses, I'd like to get some of the bricks. So I remember that was the first job where I had making money. Because I would get the bricks and we would, I forget how much he was giving us. But we would, then later on I got a gang of kids and then we would go down there and get the bricks and store them in his basement and he would pay us. Then later on my mother made carnations for Mother's Day and we used to sell those. Then the Amsterdam News, they had a place down on Fulton Street, opposite the Fulton Street Park or near there. And I used to sell Amsterdam News papers. And that's it. Tommy Watkins Sr., I guess he's dead now, but he was the one that used to kind of monitor the kids and give us the papers and talk to them. At Christmas time, he'd give a party for us. So that's one of the things. Then later on, when I moved downtown, I worked in the hardware store, running errands, and then later on, selling stuff and cutting pipes and getting, you know, doing everything. And, but I was still going to school, I think so. They were part-time jobs. Later on, I worked in a butcher, making deliveries. And then, like, it was an old guy and his wife, so their children didn't join in to do too much. So I would help them, and I would stay as long as they want me to. So he started teaching me a lot of things, what to do around the butcher, prepare the meats and things like that. So, that, but I was fascinated by airplanes going over there, so I always kept an eye out for airplanes and trying to figure out how they work. And there were a couple of automobile shops. Now, those were the black business I remember, besides the barbershop. There was a black automobile mechanic. He had a shop on Dean Street near Rochester. And so I would always go over there and watch him take apart engines and things and cars, so begin to learn how they operated. And then there was a, I think it's still there, there was a factory on Dean Street between Rochester and Utica on the south side. They had a machine shop and a whole number of things they did there. So I used to be able to look in the window and watch what they were doing, how they were shaping metal into and making different things. See, so, but I was picking up skills and I would go on and do different jobs at the hardware store. I worked in the YMCA operating down on Carlton Avenue. They had an old switchboard with all the different wires. So at night I worked there a couple of times. We worked a couple of hours a night. They had a bowling alley downstairs, so I used to set pins for the bowling clubs that came in two or three times a week. Later on, I think we shined shoes. Yeah, a couple of guys, we made shoe shine boxes and were selling shining shoes down in front of the main Y. Because that's during the wartime, and the sailors used to come there, so we used to make a lot of money shining all these sailors' shoes. And that, oh, then I delivered flowers. It used to be a florist. Right where that place is down there, Bam, now, there was buildings there, and there was a florist there. I remember I used to deliver flowers for that flower shop. So a number of little, you know, odd jobs.
What organizations of black people were around that you remember being active?
Mostly the Boy Scouts, I consider, and the church.
Were there any fraternal organizations right there?
They were around, but I used to see the adults, but I wasn't aware. Yeah, I'm not familiar with the name, but I know the organization. Because my family, like mostly, so for social life, dealt around, focused around, or was around the church and the school, and then the few relatives that were here.
You said your father had lost a house on, the family lost the house on Green Street during the Depression.
Yeah.
Was he trying to get another house afterwards?
Well, evidently he was saving money, because then when my uncle was in real estate, had a building that he thought my father could afford. That's the one on Cumberland Street. My father bought that building. Mm-hmm. Then later on, he came up here and bought this 652 St. Mark's.
Okay. And your uncle was in real estate in Brooklyn?
Yeah.
Oh. What neighborhoods did he work out of most?
Well, mostly Bedford-Stuyvesant, because he had a place on Tompkins Avenue. And he owned a lot of buildings back in Bed-Stuy. You know, back around what we call Tompkins, Stuyvesant Avenue, Putman, Halsey, all in that area. They were mostly in Franklin Avenue, so they're mostly focused in that area.
What was his name, your uncle?
Charles Haynes.
Okay. And that was his realty firm, Charles Haynes Realty?
Yeah.
Okay. How important were families back in the 1940s, 1950s for black people in Brooklyn?
Oh, that was it, because, you know, people didn't have much money, so what food and clothes and things had to do with family. And instead, we used to, among ourselves, my brothers and sisters, we used to, like, play with each other a lot and exchange ideas or whatever it was, pretend you're playing some game. So that family was very close, see. And we didn't have as much, I don't remember as much violence as you have today, so. But what little things came up, your brothers and sisters came, you know, to back you up, you see, so. But they were always, see, then also, when I went to PS 83, there was a black teacher there named Miss Duckett. And I had my older sister, Alma, she was going to school ahead of the rest of us. And she was very smart, and a lot of people liked her. So every time I went to school, that's the standard that we had to meet, match, see, like your sister, see, so. So those are kind of, so that that kind of shaped how whether while or what, you know, whether you can get in trouble or not. Plus, and I think about it often that everything they used to say in church and everything they said, my adults said, I used to believe, see. If they said that God's going to kill you, I believed it, see. So I didn't stray too far from following, you know, walking a straight line, so. So that's me. I used to see other kids do things, but I don't know how far they went because I don't know where it came from, and I remember my parents never really preached that much. But if something didn't appear right to me, I left. See, I didn't hang out with no crowd or someone that wasn't doing something right. So.
You were one of the people who helped to, in fact, discover, mm-hmm. rediscover Weeksville mm-hmm. and the houses that mm-hmm. were remaining there from dating back to 1830s. Could you just tell us, bring us up to date, take me from your adolescence to how that happens?
But as I said, growing up, I was doing many things. I wasn't aware of the Weeksville, or what the significance that community was about. And I wasn't even aware of the history connected with almost anything. Like most kids going to school, you didn't like history. After leaving grade school, I went to Harron High School and studied aviation. There, where if you were aware of racial prejudice, when you start learning certain trades and skills, some people would tell you, you know, people say, oh, why are you going to aviation? Because black people are not into aviation and they're not going to hire you. In certain jobs, people would tell you. Black people would tell you this, and then one or two white friends would tell you the same thing. So anyway, I studied aviation in Harron High. The war ended when I came out, so all these veterans are coming back, so they got first preference at all these jobs with airlines. And later on I read, of course, and I knew also that the airlines just didn't hire black people, not even as mechanics. So, but I still liked it, so I studied it, anything mechanical. But I worked a lot of little odd jobs, I say delivery boy and stuff like that. But I kept with the flying, and one of the things, while I was going to Harron, I met some students there, some black students who were taking some flying lessons, who lived in Harlem, by the way, and they were taking some lessons from a pilot that came back from that was part of Tuskegee Airmen, and he was a flight instructor named Archie Smith. So I asked them, where are they taking these flying lessons? So they said, well, we go out to Long Island, so Deer Park, every Sunday. So I asked them, could I go? So we had to go over to Harlem, meet them, and then I think one of the kids, their father, drove us out to Long Island, or if not, later on I learned to take the Long Island Railroad and went out there. And the guy used to teach us to fly for $3 an hour. And part of the money came from, most of that money that time was shining shoes, so we were shining shoes to have money to go flying on a Sunday. And from that, I ended up getting my license. And one day, Best I started getting a very bad reputation back in the late 50s, 60s, as a civil rights thing. All of a sudden, you start seeing about Bed-Stuy, they use that as a code word, black neighborhood, bad black people or something. Because a lot of white people have moved out of the area. So I decided that I would go and take pictures of that neighborhood and might try to do a book. So I met this guy. In the meantime, I had moved along and was working for Transit. I had worked the job, and there was a guy there who was a photographer, so he agreed that we would go and do these pictures. And we started, but then he got drafted. So we never finished that project. And so I had these photographs, and then about that time, they started tearing down those buildings that the Children's Museum was located in. And they opened this temporary thing up here called Muse. And they started a community organization to try to keep that museum closed. There was talk about moving this museum and down back behind the Brooklyn Museum. So they formed a community thing to fight to keep it here. So I joined that group. So that's how I used to be up in Muse all the time. And then they had these different workshops, and they asked them, why don't they have one in aviation? They said, well, if you start it, if you get someone to teach it, we'll include it in our program. So that's how I got started there with that. And while I used to go to every Friday night with that program, one day I was showing the guy, got one of the guards, the pictures that we had taken of these doors and houses in Bed-Stuy. He says, the guy that comes in here who's doing the same thing, he said, when I get in contact with him, or if he comes back, I'll get his address. About 10 minutes later, I get a call from the guard to come downstairs because that guy was there, and that's Jim Hurley. So then he told me what he was doing, and so that's how I got involved weeks ago. But when he heard that I was flying, he mentioned that he was trying to take, he used to be an aerial photographer in the war, and he was trying to get pictures of Bed-Stuy in this neighborhood. So I said, oh, I go flying every Sunday, so I'll just, you know, make arrangements, we go and we take pictures. So that's how that picture snapping thing took place. And what he was primarily looking for is the lot lines, because even though you see these blocks cut square, this house here, and if you look at the lot plot plan, it's not a square lot. It goes down straight there, and it's tapering. You're straight on that side and tapering because a road used to go down through here. So a lot of these backyards have irregular shapes that you can see from the air, but you can't see on the ground. So that's how we got looking to that. We got the Hunter Fly Road, where it went, and those houses that it was part of a road that ran north-south like a bridge system. So that's how that led up to the Wheatsville. Yeah.
And who then joined in to help form the Society for the
Well, Jim Hurley, let me see, it was part of a Youth in Action program. It grew out of that, and then they decided when they tore down the house and started finding artifacts, he decided to form. Oh, he had a couple of students, Dolores McCullough, I think a lady named Johnson, I forget her first name. There were students of his down in Pratt, in some urban program. And so, those two, myself, and the number, they decided, well, and a couple other people would form an organization. And then from there, we went down. When they started getting grants, then they needed to form, we have a chairperson or executive director. So that's when we had that Barbara Jackson, who came out of, she came from upstate, but then she went down into, I think she later on ended up in the museum of, the museum was on the west side of Manhattan, up in Harlem, up in Manhattan. Museum of Natural History, she was involved with that. But she's the first one. Then we got Shirley Chisholm to get involved with us and had this exhibit down at the community college. And then, organization just grew, and then eventually Joan. As people got, more and more people became aware of it. Some people, the bug bit them like Joan, and they've been there ever since.
If I were to go walking with you through Crown Heights or through Central Brooklyn, what things would you point out to me that represent African American culture here, or the African American contribution?
No, here, not too much. It may be because I'm biased. That one time, Jim Hurley, through Jim Hurley, we used to give a walking tour down through here and do all the architects. So we knew it was European and. So I kind of still see that today, I look at the building. And you think about the black, the black president in Brooklyn before all this came in. And what history, I know there was other villages other than Wheatsville. So I think of that, but I don't see anything around it other than the fact that they're here. Not too many businesses. They're business, but not that many. And maybe the people themselves, that's the thing I know, in the neighborhood here, living in this neighborhood, of black people would, you name the skill they have, actually, from mathematicians, historians, you name artists, designers, they're here. But not in the buildings themselves or any, physical things, the people.
Okay, so you would point at the people.
The resources, the human resources in the neighborhood, they can do anything.
Do you think generally people understand the black community in Crown Heights?
No, Kamucha, I'm reading a book about, there's a book about West Indians in the New York or something like that. And that author focusing on a certain set of people that he thinks represent the neighborhood. So they have one experience in, see.
Casnet, the Caribbean New York book. Yeah, okay.
So, but there's other group he never even touched. And so therefore he has like one perspective, one viewpoint of it. And it's so varied, see.
What about the media representation of Crown Heights?
No, well, they come in for a quick, see, they want to capsulize a maybe 100-year history in 2 minutes, and it's hard to do, so they don't, they have a bad view, and they tend to characterize everybody when they do talk about it. So theirs are not that good.
When you think back over the past years or decades in this place, in this neighborhood, what are the big events that come to your mind? Personal or public?
Oh, in terms of public things, like the blackout. Mm-hmm. The blackout they had. Okay, there was two of them. One of them I lived in Epic Shield at the time, but the second one I lived here, working here. And I remember the lights blinked, so I said, well, I'll go. I thought it was something to do with the house, I saw go. And I was doing working on the ceiling or something. I said, I'll take a break and come back. But by the time I got to the corner, people were looting stores left and right. And that, to me, still to this day, shocked me how. Because I had asked a number of people who were looting, how do you know the lights are not going to come on right back on and the cops can be in? But they kind of sensing it like an angle or whatever it was that this came out. And they, even good folks I knew up and down, they were looting stores and loading up their cars and everything. So that still puzzles me, even though it might be, other than the hoodlums, I mean, the bulk of people are peaceful. When something like that springs, you know, happens, how they sense and they run out and they try to rip off as much as they can.
This was the mid-70s, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
That still, today, that still puzzles me, like how that happened. And it just indicates that there's an underlying current of resentment or anger or something. Or feel that anything they can do to get even, or to get ahead or get for nothing, they've been doing it for.
That sense of anger, is that a common sense still? Is that still there?
Among the people?
Yeah.
I imagine so, because there's a lot of, see, I talk to a lot of people, white and black, but mostly white on the job. I said, see, there's often, many times, they'll say, oh, the United States do not want to do such a thing because, or do a certain thing because they don't want to send the wrong signal or message to some adversary, see. But I don't think they realize they're doing the same thing to their own people. So just like the other day in the job they sent out, they're selecting a guy who's a... to be a board member of the safety board. And somebody in Congress is criticized because they have to build him. They're criticizing the selection of this candidate. But this happens all the time, but they're just focusing on this. And it's just one of those things that you can put your hands on. That here's this guy, he said he has absolutely no background had to do with transportation whatsoever. Nothing, other than the fact that he has a driver's license. Mm-hmm. And who the people are backing him, this is like, I think he's a friend of Al Gore's or something like that. And those congressmen, they're going to back him. They're saying, well, he's an innovator. See? He's very innovative. He can come in and he's going to do this and that and the other. So I, as a professional, looking at that, I said, see, if I walked into a place and say I have absolutely no skills in this discipline whatsoever, but you just, I can be on the job every day on time. I'll be here every day. You can call me anytime. And I can do this, that, and the other. And I can learn quick. They'll kick you out the door. So I think a lot of black people see this, see, and they notice and that this goes. I hear kids talk about things like that if this was a white person, this would not have happened. And these kids weren't even around during the 60s, some of them. They didn't even experience any of this, but yet still they have that perception. So there's something sending a signal. I said, I think it's things like that, even though they don't read those papers or watch TV, but whatever they hear, either some adult or somebody here on the radio or whatever, that's the way they look at them. See, like this thing with Crown Heights, see, they keep focusing on the Yanko, you know, the, what's his name?
Yanko Rosenbaum.
Yanko Rosenbaum. See, which again, nobody denies that that's not, that was a tragedy. But then that's where they start the story. It's just like they start the history of the United States when Columbus got here. They don't talk about the people that were here already. See? So there's this here, they don't start seeing this, I think, in many cases, it just constantly reminds and reinforces people, black people's perception that they never start in any place unless it's something to do with white people. See? So I think that's one of the things that this anger or this underlying current of resentment waiting to spring out. See? And they probably see, their parents and different people see it on the job all the time. And they bring it home, so I think a lot of that feeds into it.
How did you react to the riots of 1991? I mean, you'd been here for decades, for six decades by then, in central Brooklyn.
Oh, it didn't surprise me because I had been aware for almost 20 years or more that there was tension building in that neighborhood. Because I some of the organizations, people I knew were involved with Dr. Vernon Cage. Mm-hmm. And then there was that incident where that doctor that lived in that block on Eastern Parkway wanted to go on a Saturday, but they had to start blocking that, side, you know, auxiliary street off. And if it was Saturday came and you wanted to go bring stuff to work in your house and you wanted to sit, you couldn't do it because the cops were going to stop you. I knew someone that lived on Pleasant Street, and I remember that where you couldn't see a cop anyplace around it, there was always a cops over there. And I think when people start complaining, they start putting them in playing cars, their own cars. The policemen would use their own personal cars, so you wouldn't be aware that they were there. So this has been slowly building. Then there was a couple of things politically wise that the services and things that the city bestowed in that city section that they didn't do for the black community. So this is slowly building. So that was just you light a fuse, eventually it reaches the critical mass and it blows it up. And that, I went through that neighborhood during the middle of that, and one block would be a lot of people throwing stones and the police and this, and the other, nothing was happening, just cops standing around and people standing around. See? So it, and one of the things that I watched the media, and I said, whenever that thing with Dinkins, they need to look at that tape. There were just as many Hasidims came out there and threw bottles and rocks because they weren't going to stand by and let anything happen. See? So everybody got involved in that brawl. Then the other thing I noticed that at night I had dropped, we had a meeting in Weeksville and I was dropping a couple of people off. And I said, you got to be crazy for me to drop to go through this neighborhood. Go through these streets with all this. The streets that were open, not all were open. I think it was Utica, maybe Schenectady. With all the, I said, you gotta be crazy. So anyway, we went through, and one block they were shooting, because the cops were coming behind the car and somebody was shooting from the things that we just zipped through. But I noticed maybe about down the Empire, I saw these kids coming with basic football helmets on and sticks and stuff like, and they looked like Hispanics, so they didn't look like they had come from that neighborhood. They looked like they had come from someplace else just ready to join into the fray. And the next day, or either 2 days late, the next day, they had that subway accident on 14th Street. And so I had to respond from my job, and I saw Lee Brown. And I said to him, one of the things I think your policemen should be doing is that if anybody comes in like that, and they're talking about these kids, I said, I would have had a number of two or three policemen trail them, attached to that group to see what they're up to. And, or if they didn't live there, get out of here. But I just saw a lot of policemen just standing around. And these people were infiltrating, coming in. And like when they reached a critical mass, then things would explode. So, but, and so I knew, but I said there was a lot of tension building because I know people that lived over there had houses, and that's something where you know, as I read, I know they would try to buy their house and then try to ransom out of it. One time there's a house that came up for auction in that block, and because through the city administrator, I remember I went down there, and the Sedums came in and said, you can't auction this house, but we want it for our school. I said, what do you mean? This thing has to go to auction. They didn't win it. I didn't win it either, but a black guy won it. But I don't know what, I think he might have sold it to them. But that's the kind of, drive that they were putting in, that I guess people would perceive as being pushy. And people trying to take over their neighborhood.
Do those tensions still exist there? Has anybody?
I don't know. I haven't been in touch with anybody over there. And people I know have long, moved or gone. Mm-hmm. And I don't, I'm not aware of them.
What do you think that Crown Heights needs? What would help Crown Heights in the next decade?
Well, not just Crown Heights. I think they just, Crown Heights just have to be a pimple on a hope, on some beast that needs correcting. And I think it goes back to like slavery. This country has never acknowledged officially about slavery. They still act like it didn't happen. And they're doing a lot of stuff. And so then they push, like, why this right? So there's a perception that a lot of even white people who are decent people, they think that somehow they're more superior. So that atmosphere is constantly created. And they don't deny, and you go on jobs, no matter what the skills of the people, they'll say, well, that person got that job because of equal opportunity thing. They never say, well, maybe that person is that skill. Well, they can see. They might work and see every day. Boy, that person is smart. And they say, but they'll look at it, that no, he got it from some equal opportunity thing. So that happened on my job. You have to have skills to get on that job and experience. Yeah, still a lot of whites think that the blacks they see there, that's what happened to them. See? And they always have this superior position. And then that's fostered by the media, just by what you see. And I remember one time, an African guy was going to this country. He said, if I didn't see black people, I wouldn't believe black people lived here. From what I see on TV. And that was about 4 or 5 years ago. But now you see a little more black faces. But this constant climate of always seeing these white faces doing everything. And even when the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas hearing took place, one of the reactions was, I think some of the people that came to testify for Anita Hill, the black people, the one day, one of the big reactions was, I didn't realize there were so many articulate and educated black people around. That's a big reaction that came down. See, so that shows you that's what's under the cover there. So when something like Crown Heights come in, it just explodes. So once the people realize that they're not superior and they're all equals, they're all Americans and we're all striving for the same goals, I think maybe to start breaking that tension. It's just like seeing this program. They did a program where they took these black kids and took them up to, they took them to Israel, that's what it was. And of course, they treated them very well. And I think almost any tourist going someplace, unless there's a bunch of really angry people like maybe in the middle of Soweto or something, if you take a tourist go someplace or a visitor, he's treated very well. So these black kids who always see this rough stuff in their neighborhood, when they went there and got this nice reception, they stayed in people's homes and the people treated them well. They now set up a thing, even though it was nice to expose them to that life, those kids, from what I'm seeing, that reading that article and listening to them, they thought that they're going to think for the rest of their life that white people are the best thing since sliced bread. See? They need to take some white kids and take them to some of these places and show them right here. Like Mississippi, there was a couple of articles about last week, I think they did a town in Mississippi, in some of these little places, and see what people undergo. But of course, you take them and put them in a good situation, any kid, I don't care what they are, put them in a good situation and environment, they're going to react to it in a positive way. And interesting enough, I know, again, this thing that sends a signal. I used to have a friend of mine, he lives down on Pacific Street now, he's from Jamaica. And he, like, reads the Bible. And one day he said, boy, you know, God really, black people really must have done something because the way God treats them. The white people have everything, achieve everything. And I told him, I have to show you a videotape. I taped the program. They were talking to this old white, old black guy down in, someplace down in Georgia. But something about 70, 80 years old. He said almost the identical thing. So here he's poor. He sees a white guy go by in a car. He sees a nice house. So you figure, and he doesn't relate it to what some of the things that historically took place in this country that kept him in the same position. And then again, so he equates and he says, oh, it must be something to do with our skin and our, we are inferior people. So that's another feeling that floats down to people who don't have the high esteem. See, then a lot of white people figure, you know, I think we talk a lot about the Civil War, and I was once thinking if I can get somebody and I know to do playwriting, they should just go take the black codes that came out after the Civil War and just read them on the stage and see what they did. The black codes, also what the exclusionary things they had against Chinese or Asians over in California. I mean, these were not somebody, something, somebody. This was on paper, see, and they enacted them. So these underlying things that is not talked about here in this country. Then this thing with Jeffries, that really is a really good study, whether you like Jeffries or not, of what happened to him. That it clearly shows that the material that he was used, source material he was used, was written by Jews, about Jews. So he reports it, and he's like an anti-Semitic. I mean, everybody from the mayor on down, I mean, the governor, they blast him, and none of them read that. I don't think any of them have done any research in it. And nobody says any, you know, but. He speaks his mind. He doesn't let nobody set his agenda, particularly white people. And he's almost like the Malcolm. He says what he wants to say. But and he focuses on the glories of black African people. So they don't like that. But when he brings up this source material, then he's anti-Semitic. And I doubt if any of them watch the tape. I listen to a lot of talk radio at work. And and you try to call in. Very few of those people who call in, very few of the people who run the shows, this and the governor on down, have ever watched the whole tape of where he made the thing. They were talking about multicultural. And he was just showing, hey, these things are not in the books. So we get a perception that these people are all good people, but they were, and he wasn't only talking about Jews, he was talking how all these institutions that we hold in high and mighty, and that they were involved in the slave trade, and even he talked about black people were involved in it, but they just took that one little segment out and went berserk with it. And I heard the other day a woman was called, some guy called in talking about Sharpton, that he talked about the Jewish diamond merchant or something. And so the lady said, yeah, that's why I don't like him. He's anti-Semitic, you know. She said, I like him, but that's the wrong statement, because this guy was calling that he's anti-Semitic. If they had just read the Sunday Times the week before, they did a book review on De Beers, see, the Last Empire, and they're talking about De Beers. That same phrase, that it was run by the German, the Jewish diamond merchants, see. And this is showing you, Jewish families that organized that, and who owns it. So if you go on the radio, you say something in public, oh, you're anti-Semitic. So that itself showed me that they still got this, not only Jews, but the Jews happen to be in the media, I think, has brought us to the in the spotlight that they focus on. But a lot of you show that, hey, these people did this. They go on to the front and you say, this is part of history. I was listening, because I got a tape from Plato Benjamin, that talk back program. He had an interview with Lawrence Katz, the guy who do Black Indians. See? And Katz is not championing like he should be outside the black community, because when he talks about the West, he destroys this image that there were blacks, there were Indians holding. who did a lot of things. And some of the people that they show portray in the movie and in history as being white were really black. And see, they don't want that image destroyed because that's the macho man, Superman, the independent, what Americans are all about. So now, this guy is sewn on ground in terms of academic circles. He's not a PhD, so his work's no good. But he's got, he goes to their own records and finds this stuff. Say, hey, here's your own records. So that shows me that even to the day, this white superiority thing's out there. They don't want it destroyed. This thing with the immigrants, they don't want, you know, now, because the immigrants don't look like them, not Europeans. They're very, very annoyed about it. Very upset. There's a very tense thing in this whole country about immigrants.
Speaking of that, let me ask you about black immigrants to Crown mm-hmm. Heights, Caribbeans, mm-hmm. Haitians, Jamaicans, Barbadians. Mm-hmm. How much contact was there between native-born black people and Caribbeans as they came in? I mean, they come in large numbers in the 70s, late 60s, 70s and 80s.
Well, even before that, see, my father was a Barbadian, and so mm-hmm. And my mother's in the South, so like many times we would be called monkey chasers because of the West Indians, and people knew about it. And then if you're among West Indians later, oh, you're not from home, you're a Yankee. See, my wife was from Guyana, and I remember many times we would go places and people would say, oh, is he from home? And she says, no. You see, a whole different reception could take place. Mm-hmm. And so you have these little cliques. So it's not even among, there is a division among, American blacks and the West Indian blacks. And they're rallying around a particular thing, see. But even among themselves, there's a different, Jamaicans and Haitians. I know Jamaicans don't like Haitians and I don't know too many Haitians. I never heard them express anything, but I know I've heard other Caribbeans talk about other Caribbeans. Mm-hmm. They don't trust Trinidadians, they don't trust Jamaicans, and this and that. They go through all that stuff. See? So there's a division there. But they'll rally, they'll come together if it's if some American black is attacking them, whether it's in discussion or physically. And because, again, they don't know the historical background. I've met some that once they learn the history and they see the common battle, that the common struggle that we've gone through, then they lighten up. And I think there's a lot of little talk and study groups that are going around in the black community. And so there's a lot of discussion I think that people are seeing more and more. And even though it still exists among the larger population, there's at least a little glimmers of hope here and there. So.
If I were to give you a chance now to say something to black kids growing up in Crown Heights today, something out of your own experience, or what message would you send to them?
Well, it's a message. I talk to a lot of kids all the time, and one thing I tell them, I read the history, and I'm very aware of a lot of things that whites have done against black, but it's no use carrying around that hatred, prejudice. See, you try to correct it. And, the positive. And it's a struggle sometimes. Sometimes it's painful. But you can't carry along around the hate, because racial prejudice is a negative thing, and you can't carry it around. And I said, you never know. You might run across some white person, and that's the one who's going to save your life. And so you just have to. And I said, I've known white people who have been more dedicated to not helping black, but been working with blacks and on equal basis. And more so than some black people. Right? So I said, you just look, you look at one individual at a time, and eventually it's a whole group of people, and you realize that it varies the relationship and how they react towards you as a black person. And so you just can't take a blanket thing and say all white people hate black people. See? And again, as some it's been said many times, we're on one planet, so that's it, so you better make the best of it. And you try to make the best of it as peaceful and, have a good quality of life without a lot of strife.
If I were to do the same and give you a chance to tell New York about Crown Heights and about the people who live here, what would you say?
Oh, first of all, I'd say most of them are very good people, hardworking people. And, you know, they don't hate people just because of color of their skin. Something has to trigger it off. There's people at, you know, various educational levels, but basically good people, and they could, you know, they're given a chance. They can, you know, they can contribute. They are contributing in their own little way. And they're not out here striking out at anybody, just taking care of their own little daily thing. But they're basically just like any other American, you know. So you might not like, some people might not like them because they, you know, or cotton to them, as they say, because they're black. But if they look at their behavior and what they do, they're no different than what happened in some of the white communities across the country. So you have to look at Crown Heights that way, see. But the, one of the things as you start, see now that label, now that puts a label, you can't, that's the area. So now, because of what people see in the media, which educate people more than colleges do and school do, that now means one thing. And so the minute you say Crown Heights, in the brain, it triggers off a whole bunch of things. So I think what, well, the people in Crown Heights, they know, like when they were talking about the Korean boycott down in Flatbush, which was not Crown Heights, but it was, what the media never showed and what I never saw anybody discuss is right next door was another Korean store that people were going to. All the Korean stores down through here, through Crown Heights, people were going to. And they had no problem. Even when they had the one on Fulton Street, the boycott, they were going to other Korean stores all around here. So it might be some incident that started between two individuals, but then all of a sudden, this thing, because race hasn't been cleared up in this country yet, that becomes the focal point. The Koreans versus the black and this, and then they still, the media still talks about that. They don't talk about that. Most of the black people here still go to Korean stores. I've seen a few interviews on TV where they stop and people say, hey, we have citizens who live next door in Crown Heights. We don't have any problem. And they've been doing that for a long time. See, and they weren't involved in that, what do you call it, in the riot or at all. See? So it needs to be shown that there's a variety of people in Crown Heights of different Caribbeans, from Caribbeans to blacks from down south. And they get along with anybody. And they, even the Hasidims, and the Hasidims get along with them. And it's not those few that got involved in, you know, the, whatever the number got involved in that particular incident over in Calvin Cato. Because I certainly wasn't out there throwing rocks, and I live in Crown Heights. And most of the people in this block weren't in there. Let's see. And a lot of people thought that it was wrong for the riot to explode, you know. So, but I think the media is feeding a lot. And that's a sad thing, too. That I read a lot of the paper. I'm a newspaper reader. But in one of the little study groups, we used to bring the papers in. They met every Thursday night. And look in the paper and you see how they write articles that feed false information. And I listen to people that call in the talk radio. They don't know Sharpton. Because I did some work for Sharpton and I was around him a while. And I realized how smart this guy is. But I see what the media snaps up. And like, I know people, they never seen, even black people never seen Sharpton. But they have very strong negative opinions about him. But then if they ever get a chance to be in an audience with this guy for a while and see, then they realize, wait a minute, this isn't the person that I thought I knew. So it can show you how the media shaped opinion and on things. And so, I don't know, the major papers are not going to do it. Some of the local black papers have been trying to do it, but I don't. So maybe the community need to print their own newsletter, see, and get it out. And maybe something like this where you're trying to talk to different people in the community, see how they, what their experiences have been. Because all the while I was in that few nights, and one night I went through there, I was in what I seen on the radio and the TV, wouldn't even, you know, you wouldn't have been aware of it. Even though I try to keep aware of a lot that's going on, but you still can't. And a lot of people in this block, that might as well have taken place in China. It's closer to what? And I know people that live within a half a block of it didn't see it as that big a thing. They knew there was some disturbance up there, they saw the cops, but that's it. So that, you know, so don't get fooled by the word Crown Heights, you know, you need to find out what it's about.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Appreciate your time. Okay.